this week, we have Ed Mitchard here with us. He's a senior lecturer at the University of Edinburgh. Ed leads a research group working on developing and testing methods of using remote sensing data from satellite and drones to map carbon stocks of tropical forests and savannas. His research focuses on integrating satellite data with forest inventory and community-led ground data in order to monitor and hopefully reduce tropical deforestation and degradation. More generally, he is very interested in both the international and NGO project-level processes for reducing carbon emissions and encouraging sustainable development, and all efforts to encourage people towards higher living standards that simultaneously protect our planet's vital ecosystem services. So, thank you, Ed. Welcome.
Thank you very much for that introduction, and thanks for inviting me to come here. Delighted to be able to talk to you all. You'll seem to have gone as far away from me as you can. I hope you can all hear me. Wave if you can't, and I'll try and speak louder. I don't think I'm mic'd up. So, yes, I'm at the University of Edinburgh, and basically my research, the main focus of my research is trying to solve this problem. We currently don't really have any handle on the amount of carbon coming in or out of the tropics, out of tropical forests. It could be that the tropics are a big sink, taking in lots of carbon, lots of the excess carbon dioxide we're pumping into the atmosphere through our deforestation and degradation, our burning of fossil fuels, or it could be that it's a rather large source to the atmosphere as we're cutting down those same forests and burning the result. This is a very large range of numbers, a range of about 4 petagrams of carbon. To put that in context, anthropogenic carbon emissions from fossil fuels are about 9 petagrams of carbon a year, a number which we know with much greater certainty. So the causes of this uncertainty have a few different causes. When I started my PhD about 11 or 12 years ago, we didn't really have a good idea of how much carbon was stored in the tropics of forests, the kind of above-ground biomass of the tropics. We now know that with much greater certainty. So you can see the range of forest carbon stocks locked up in tropical trees is known relatively well. We can still do some more work here. But this uncertainty is not big enough to explain that uncertainty. The real difficulties are the sizes of these two fluxes. We don't know how much carbon is being lost through deforestation and degradation with much accuracy at all, with much of the error there being caused by this degradation term. And we don't know how much carbon is being sucked in by forests due to increasing carbon stocks in forests, intact forests that we're leaving alone. We know this is happening, but we don't know the size. And if you look at the uncertainties combined with the different combinations of those two, it's how you get to this range of uncertainties. So this has real negative consequences. This isn't just an academic problem. For example, if we're trying to do some kind of program called reducing emissions from deforestation and degradation, whereby wealthy countries pay developing countries to stop deforesting their forests, we need to be able to monitor this bit, to target spending, and to know whether or not it's working. And we have all these, a lot of research efforts going into climate modelling, which is clearly necessary in order to predict what's going to happen in the future and, again, to plan our mitigation efforts. But if we can't test whether climate models are correct, if we don't know what the truth is, and similarly we can't kind of tweak those climate models to make them better match reality. So it's a genuine issue that I'm trying to work on. The technology I work on mostly is using satellite data to try and improve these estimates. There's various ways in which you can estimate the change in carbon stocks of the tropics, but the only one that can see all the tropical forests at once and really understand what's going on relies on satellite data that orbit the Earth. We can do it in other ways. For example, you can use ground plots. The most accurate way to estimate the biomass of a tropical forest would be to go into an area of the tropical forest, cut down all the trees with chainsaws and weigh them. Clearly, that's quite destructive and more of a problem, to be honest, quite expensive. So instead, we tend to measure the diameter and height of the trees, use some kind of allometric equation to relate that diameter and height to their carbon storage. That's quite accurate, time-consuming, and you can't even access some places. So we need to know what's happening to carbon stocks, how they're changing in eastern DRC. But no one's going to let me go and go into a war zone and set up plots. Similarly, some places are simply hard to get to. So satellite data provides an opportunity to collect consistent data sets across the world's forests. They're also quite consistent measurements. We try to do forest plots in the same way everywhere. There are handbooks on how to measure tree biomass and height. for example, the Rainfall Plot Handbook. But fundamentally, people will do this a bit differently in different places and in different times. We're not really certain that diameter is measured the same way as it was in the 1950s. Satellite data lets us collect the same data around the whole world and keep collecting the same types of data each year, so we can track changes with more consistency and hopefully therefore more accuracy. So the first type of satellite data I'm going to talk about is the main type that's collected. It's called optical satellite data. Effectively, it's a bit like a digital camera on a satellite looking down at the Earth. There's about 500 optical remote sensing satellites in orbit that are working at the moment. This is a map of satellites around the world. This is circa 2017. Most Earth observation satellites are in this bit quite close. They're in low Earth orbit. There are some that are in the geosynchronous orbit, just much further away with a big telescope, but most of them are whizzing around. Once every few hours, they're collecting an image of a different bit of the world crossing the equator. It's about 11 a.m. each day locally. These have been used a lot to make maps of deforestation and forest cover, and they work really well from that. Effectively, if you imagine looking out to the International Space Station, you could imagine if you can see the Earth's surface, you can see whether or not a pixel is green or non-green. If it's green, there's probably forest there. If it's not green, it's probably something else. And looking at pixels that change from green to not green, you can map deforestation pretty well. And indeed, that process has been automated. There's a product which has been advertised a lot as the Global Forest Watch product. It's produced by Matt Hansen, his group at the University of Maryland, which uses all the Landsat data since 2000 to map forest change very accurately. So they've used about 1 million Landsat scenes to produce this 30-meter resolution map of forest change. It has some issues as any global product would when you look at it in small areas, but it's thought to be pretty good, and that's been very widely used. It's been, since that was published in 2013, there's about 1,500 papers, and goodness knows how many reports published using that data directly. So this has really opened up satellite analysis to many more people. For a longer time, individual countries have been using satellite data to map forest change as well. So the PRODES product is quite well known. It's produced by INPEI, the space agency of Brazil, and again maps forest change. The results are up on the web. Anyone can use their software or look at their results. So in terms of deforestation, optical satellite data works well. There are some issues with using it to monitor forests, however. Most of the world is cloudy most of the time. They only see the top of the canopy, and there's spectral inconsistencies. So I'm just going to go through each of these in turn. So this is some lovely data from a satellite that's quite far away from Earth with a big telescope that can look consistently at a hemisphere. And this is just the month of May 2016 from this Discoverer satellite. What I want you to look for here is that the bits of the world I'm most interested in, tropical forests, unfortunately look white. So if you see South America zoom past, it will be covered in cloud, and Africa, similarly, in the tropical bit, is covered in cloud. What you can see most of the time when you look at the world from this kind of view is quite a lot of ocean, quite a lot of desert, and a lot of white cloud, none of which is going to show me deforestation. So if we're going to monitor the world using optical satellite data, we have to collect an awful lot of data in order to find cloud-free pixels. In some parts of the world, we simply don't find cloud-free pixels, never mind how many times we look. I work quite a lot in coastal Gabon, which is one of the cloudiest places in the world, and there are parts of national parks there that I have never seen. They've never been observed by satellite data because the satellites all go over the tropics, well, the equator, which is where Gabon is located. It's about 11:30 in the morning, and Gabon is always cloudy at 11:30 in the morning, so we never see these ground points. There's been hundreds of thousands of observations. So this is a map of how cloudy places are. So Scotland, where I live, is fairly cloudy. It comes up, it's about 80 to 90% of the time cloud-covered. The bits of Gabon are nearly 100% cloud-covered. Similarly, this fringe of Colombia and Ecuador, or quite a lot of Indonesia, are just consistently cloudy. This is cloud cover at midday, by the way, which is the most relevant for us for satellites. So this is a major problem with trying to use optical data. You might still get an observation that could allow you to look for deforestation, but if we're trying to look at carbon stocks, we often want several observations over a year so we could build up some idea of how the spectral signature changes over a growing season, for example, which might relate to whether the trees are deciduous or not, which might tell us something about the carbon stocks. In areas where there's cloudy, you're very unlikely to get multiple observations in a year. The other issue is that optical satellite is just looking at the top of the forest. So for obvious reasons, it can't see through the first couple of leaves at the top. So this is Budongo Forest in Uganda, another place I work quite heavily. In the example here, we have a colobus monkey sitting happily in a high biomass forest. This is pretty pristine. There might have been a bit of logging done here in the 20s, but basically this feels like intact tropical forest. Here, near a town in Budongo Forest in the south, is heavily degraded forest. This is used a lot by local people for cooking. They extract a lot of fuel wood. You can see there's a person walking there with a big bundle of logs on their head. And also a lot of trees are taken out for building and for the general construction and export to the towns near this area. These two look absolutely identical on the satellite image. You probably can't see from the back, but they're the same shade of green. There's no difference between those pixels, because in both cases you have pretty much complete cover, tropical forest trees, and it looks identical. I can't use my optical satellite data to map this degradation that's occurred. Greenness fundamentally relates to canopy cover, not biomass. That's what we're mapping. Hands up if you've heard of NDVI. Good, okay, I probably don't need to explain this to most of you, but there were some hands that didn't go up. So NDVI is the normalized difference vegetation index. It's the ratio difference between red and infrared light, and effectively if your pixel contains chlorophyll, it will have a high number near one. If your pixel doesn't contain chlorophyll, it will be zero or negative. People are often confused as to why we don't just look at greenness, but chlorophyll is evolved to absorb most optical light. Trees look green because they reflect about 15-20% of green light while absorbing almost all red and blue. Chlorophyll just isn't that great at absorbing green light, but fundamentally it's still absorbing most of it. If you've ever looked at a plane window down at forests, you might expect forests to look green, but really they look dark. They look almost black if you think about it, because they're absorbing most of the radiation hitting them. However, leaves have also evolved to reflect almost all infrared light that hits them, because infrared light is a bad thing for a leaf, because they're very exposed to the sun and they'll get very hot if they accept most radiation that isn't useful for photosynthesis. So they reflect maybe 70 or 80% of infrared radiation. There's a difference between red light, which they absorb strongly because they want to do photosynthesis, use that to create sugar, and infrared radiation that leads to this very high value for NDVI. Things that don't contain chlorophyll typically have a reflecting spectrum a bit like this. This is kind of a typical soil. Soil's kind of reddy brown because it probably reflects more in red than blue. But that's going to have an NDVI of about zero. So there are many examples of this. I've just picked one from a paper I wrote during my PhD, which shows the relationship between canopy cover and NDVI. And typically you get this kind of relationship. So as canopy cover goes up, NDVI goes up, until you get to about canopy closure. So here about 1 meter squared of canopy per meter squared of ground. And then this relationship saturates, and you get no further increase in NDVI as you layer more and more leaves on top of each other, because it makes no difference, because the satellite's only seeing the very top layer. So what I want you to conclude from this graph is that greenness is a good measure of canopy cover, so you could use it maybe to look at degradation. There'll be changes in canopy cover as you degrade forest beyond a certain intensity, but probably very poor for mapping carbon stocks, because canopy cover covers are increasing as you get more and more layers of trees. Biomass will carry on increasing, but this NDVI will stay flat, it will saturate. Okay, the final problem with using optical data to map changes in forests or changes in biomass is that you have inconsistent spectral signatures. I've just pulled up a couple of Landsat scenes over Budongo Forest. So the one I showed you before was this dry season, where you can nicely see the forest patch and the surrounding savanna and farmland is dry and non-green. However, if you looked in the wet season, you'd really struggle to see where the trees are compared to where the agriculture is, because all the grass and crops are green as well. Subtler changes also happen within forests, relating to leaf age. If some trees may drop their leaves in the dry season, flowers can change the spectral signature. If you have a tree with lots of flowers at the top at some point of year, fundamentally your pixel values can change during the year, but nothing to do with the canopy cover, nothing to do with the biomass, which might be really quite stable. Your spectral signature will change. Something that troubles actual remote sensing scientists like me a lot, and maybe not people who use the data very much, you use the Hansen product, you never ever worry about atmospheric correction. A lot of what I actually do in order to use these images is try to correct for differences in the atmosphere, differences in sun angle, to try and get consistent images. It's actually a very difficult thing to do. if there's a load of Saharan dust in the atmosphere that year compared to the previous year, you will see a different image, even if everything on the ground is the same, and it's very hard to correct that. That's less true nowadays. We have a lot of information about the characteristics of the atmosphere, which helps us. But particularly going back in the past, once you get to the 90s or the 80s, it's very hard to ever atmospherically correct an image. If you have differences in these images, it's really hard to say they're definitely due to changes in the forest as opposed to changes in the spectral characteristics of the leaves or the vegetation or changes in the atmosphere. And you have an even another thing if you're doing these long-time comparisons, in that satellite sensors are different. And again, it's really hard to know. You can't go and get Landsat 5 back and see how its characteristics have changed since it's been launched into orbit. It's really hard to compare old and new satellite sensors, see how they drift in orbit. Okay, so I've said that optical satellite data is quite good for deforestation, but might have some issues for using it for biomass, and we don't really use it to map carbon stocks. So it's not really going to help with the problem I showed you on the first slide. It might help us a bit with that red box in terms of deforestation mapping, but that's not the bit that's really uncertain anyway. It was the degradation that was the issue. So there's two other technologies I'm going to talk about, LIDAR and radar, which are different types of remote sensing that can tell us something about forest biomass. So starting with LIDAR, this is laser imaging. It's a totally different type of sensor. It sends pulses of laser light from the satellite or the drone or the plane that has the LIDAR sensor, sends them down to the forest canopy and detects the time it takes for those photons to come back to the sensor. These sensors are very accurate and can detect the difference in time between reflections that happen from the leaves on top of the canopy and reflections that happen from the ground. The difference in time of those two can give you information on the canopy height. So you can estimate the height of trees, you have a good idea of their biomass. You can also make pretty images. This is from a campaign we did in Gabon in 2014. This is LIDAR from an aircraft flying quite low. This is a training camp. I gave a lecture that included this slide in this building here, which is quite fun. So you can clearly see buildings and roofs here, and these are some tall trees. I just coloured these points by how high they are off the ground. So the red colours are the tallest trees, and going down to blues are at ground level. So you can see this data set can really contain rich information. I can pull out individual trees, know how tall they are and how wide the canopy is, and we hope that can give us some information on the biomass. And you can imagine if I go and collected the same data this year and compared the two, if I suddenly saw this tree was missing, I'd know it was actually gone. There'd be no returns from it. It's very good data to difference if you can make it line up nicely. I don't have any problem of spectral inconsistency because this is a real physical measurement of the trees. The tree is still there, it's going to appear. So it can map tree height and canopy size. Between those, you can often make biomass. This is a seminal paper produced by Greg Asner, which produced a biomass map very accurately for a lot of the Peruvian Amazon based on real LIDAR data. So rather than extrapolating from optical data or from field plots and doing some kind of regression analysis like that, there was actually records of where the trees were. This is a few different types of disturbance shown. So again, this is coloured from blue to red. I've done the same scale as the previous slide. This here is an example of selective logging. So this is forest that has had these little blue canopy gaps where individual large trees have been taken out. It's an example of cattle ranching where you have big clearings where whole areas of trees have been removed. And you can see very clearly this is a village, some urban development. This is a road, and you can see kind of loss of all tall trees from these patches of remnant forest next to a town. This is really powerful data for picking out forest biomass. You can compare it to plot data based on a full plot. So if I measure the biomass from the ground of a 1 hectare plot, I can compare it to, say, the mean or top of canopy height and get an idea of the biomass that has a tight regression. Or you can pull out the actual characteristics of individual trees. It can be quite computationally intensive, but might give you a really good idea of carbon stocks. There are some issues with turning this data into biomass, and we'll come into those later, particularly related to needing locally derived diameter height relationships and wood density. You don't actually get that information from the imagery, so to turn this from something about tree height into biomass, you need to do some field work or have some local data. So to demonstrate this in a bit more detail, LIDAR measures height. Optical data we talked about just measures the colour of this green bit, so you can see the tree could be any height or any width here and it would have the same greenness. The same is true a bit with LiDAR. It could be any width, or the wood could be any density, and we have the same height. So we have to have some local information on that. But in general, we think that height is really well correlated with biomass if you know those other factors. So there are some issues with LiDAR. I have a project. We now own a LiDAR in my group in Edinburgh, which is great. It's this 3 meter wingspan plane. It's expensive. So that was bought on a European Union ERC grant. It's about £350,000 to purchase a plane like that. And no one will insure it. So I'm a bit worried we're going to crash it into a tree and lose our investment in Gabon early next year. So this is expensive to do. You can collect it from aircraft. There are survey companies that do it. It's quite often done in the UK, for example, for mapping changes in topography or for trees even occasionally. It's expensive to collect data even in countries where a plane with a LiDAR exists. In a country in the tropics where there's no plane, we have to do things like bring our own UAV because it would cost a fortune to get a plane to fly up from South Africa to collect the data. Data volumes are often very large. Every time we fly this plane, we're going to collect about a terabyte of raw LiDAR data, which will probably take us a decent amount of time on our server to crunch and get some result out of it. Other problem with laser, say laser sensors, the laser beam will spread out inevitably. So if you collect the data from an aircraft or a UAV like this, flying a few hundred meters above the ground, you get the kind of continuous maps I just showed you where you can see every tree. Of course, what we'd really like to do is collect the data from space so it can be free for users. Can space sensors cost a lot to launch, but once they're launched, that's it. You're getting data all the time. But LiDAR from space is a very different beast from LiDAR from a plane. This is an example of the ISAT glass sensors tracks. So this was a very useful satellite that was up in the mid-2000s. It collected lots of footprints of height data, but it wasn't producing nice images like this. Instead, it collected 70-meter wide footprints, so over a 70-meter circle, you know the average height of the trees, and it collected those every 170 meters along the track, so along these tracks as it went around the world. This meant that even after its full campaign of about 7 years, it had imaged about 0.01% of the world's surface. So it's not producing continuous maps, it's producing the equivalent of lots of 70-meter wide field plots where we have point estimates of height that we can then convert into biomass. Part of the reason that figure is so low is not just because it had this kind of sampling scheme, but also because it's also affected by cloud cover. One of the great things about flying this little UAV over Gabon is that we're going to be flying underneath the clouds, so we have no cloud cover problems, whereas in space, your laser beam can't see through clouds, it's in the optical domain. Fortunately, it's going to be a new... So this satellite disappeared in, well, about 2008-9. Its laser got less and less good. There's a new one going up called JEDI. It's a NASA mission. It's going to be on the space station collecting data. It should be launched in December. It's been delayed a bit, but I'm hoping to get data all of next year. There's also a satellite called ISAT-2, which has just been launched earlier this year. I haven't seen any data yet. We should be getting more of this laser data from space, which will be useful for calibrating other methods. So we have used that ISAT glass data to make maps of global biomass. I said that during the last few years we've got a much better idea of how much biomass is in the tropics, and that was thanks to this mission, really. So using the space-worn LiDAR footprints and some ground plots, we could end up with tens of thousands of point biomass estimates across the tropics. We then managed to scale those up using optical satellite data, so effectively looking at the colours of different types of forest, and elevation data, because forests are normally different biomass depending on the elevation, as loosely as elevation goes up, biomass goes down. We did some machine learning and created biomass maps. We also ideally used some of these plots. We held them back for testing to see how good the biomass maps were. This was done in the early 2010s, quite a bit. There were two different groups that produced biomass maps that were quite well publicised. So I was involved in this one in 2011. It was the first map of above-ground biomass in the tropics. And another one came out next year at a higher resolution. So it's in Saatchi and Puccini. They use pretty much the same data set, so you'd imagine they'd be pretty similar. They both produced broadly similar average numbers, but unfortunately they actually were quite different in how they distributed biomass in space. So these are the two maps mapped up on the same scale. The previous figure was the actual figures from the papers. And you see that in general, the Puccini map sees more carbon in most places. So it sees more carbon in these bits than the Saatchi map does. And the absolute differences are really quite large, really large for some places. So for example, this bit of Papua New Guinea, where we have very little field data, we don't really know what's there very well. The Bacini map predicts about 150 tonnes more carbon per hectare than the Saatchi map, and we still don't really know what's right there. There are some pretty big differences in Gabon as well. So this bit of West Africa, the Bacini map sees a gradient towards increasing biomass as you go away from the coast. The Saatchi map sees the opposite. It sees increasing biomass going towards the coast. So again, we get about 150 tonne per hectare difference in coastal Gabon, which is pretty big. I'm pretty sure the Saatchi map is right on that one because we have field plots from there. But of course, I would say that because they're my field plots, so I know that bit of forest, that maybe that those bits of forest are unusual. So who really knows? We do, however, know some of why they differ, at least. So the two approaches use quite different relationships between diameter and height. We now know that, from a paper that came out in 2011, that diameter and height are quite different. This is just within the Amazon region. This is the global data set showing a kind of general allometric relations between diameter of trees and heights. These are quite good, well-fitting lines even across different species. And you can see that trees in Southeast Asia for a given diameter are much higher than trees in, say, the West Africa or the Brazilian Shield. Really quite large differences. And we didn't include these in the designing of these maps. The Bacini map used a single relationship between height from the glass footprints and biomass. So it was basically a kind of average line through the middle of this. And the Saatchi map didn't do much better. It used one relationship per continent. And the result of this paper suggests we should have used quite a few different relationships in different regions to get a better idea of biomass. We also assumed in all these maps that wood density, average wood density, is pretty similar. It will differ between species, but we assumed that within all the tropical forests it was about the same. We knew that was an approximation, but we didn't think it would make as much difference, and it turns out it did. We should have looked in the literature more, it turns out. This paper from 2006 showed very clearly that wood density shows a big gradient across the Amazon from about 0.5 in the fast-growing dynamic forests of southwest Amazonia up to about 0.7 in the slower-growing forests of the Guiana Shield. We assumed wood density was the same in all of them. That's going to cause a big spatial bias in our maps. We are going to underestimate the biomass of this corner and overestimate the biomass of this corner by about 20%, which is a pretty big number if you think about propagating that through to predicting carbon stock losses from deforestation. So we did some work using just field plots to see how big this effect was. So I collected a load of rainfall plot data and supplemented a bit to get a network of 413 good, trustworthy plot measurements across Amazonia. And we created an interpolated map based solely on these field plots. It's not a good map of biomass. It's an idea of how intact tropical forest trends in general across the basin. So you see that largely driven by wood density, but also just by tree height and diameter, you get a broad increase in biomass towards these high biomass forests in the Guiana Shield and low biomass in the southern and western fringes of the Amazon. The Saatchi and Bacini maps look quite different. The Saatchi map sees this low biomass in the middle. The Bacini map sees broadly similar biomass throughout. It sees a bit of a lower biomass in the south. They did disagree with each other, and they don't agree with the field plots, which is a bit of an issue. And we think that was due largely to those factors I showed earlier, differences in wood density and the differences in diameter height. That's included in this, but not in these two. So to show that graphically, these trees may be the same height, but they differ in biomass because they're different diameter. They have a different diameter-height relationship. And these two differ in biomass, even though they look identical. They would look identical in a terrestrial laser scan, but they have a factor of two difference in carbon storage because they have a factor of two difference in wood density. Neither of these problems is easy for me to fix as a remote sensor. These are both things that you need to do field measurements to understand. Fortunately, they seem to be quite conserved in space. So all the trees in an area, there may be hundreds of different species, they're all competing with each other under the same ecological conditions. So it seems that broadly diameter height relationships and wood density is quite conserved within a hectare. That wouldn't necessarily have to be the case. It would be a real problem if it was very variable by species within an area, but that doesn't seem to be the case based on our current imperfect set of field plot measurements. Okay, so to conclude this section of the talk, optical data is great for mapping canopy cover, which lets you do biomass and some degradation, as long as you can actually see the place, because of cloud cover and as long as you're prepared to correct for inconsistencies in spectral signatures with time. LiDAR data lets you do tree height and then biomass with some issues, but there are some biases because you're only measuring height, and the actual data is limited. There's very few people who own sensors that can fly over forests, and particularly for this, my frustration is that people don't tend to measure the same place twice. You'll go to an area and do your LiDAR survey, having won your 3-year grant, and have a great map of biomass, but what I really want to look at is biomass change, which means coming back in 2 years' time after some trees have been removed and some other trees have grown, and then we have data sets that we could use to calibrate satellite maps of deforestation and degradation and regrowth, but that very rarely happens. And I showed you could combine these two types of data sets to make pantropical biomass maps, but there are some limitations with those. They're not really maps of biomass, they're maps of tree height from points extrapolated using colour, so they have biases because they're not really measuring carbon, and they're limited to the mid-2000s because that's when we had a satellite that collected LiDAR data. That's about to change with these two new satellites I talked about, so for about a 10-year gap we'll suddenly have a new generation of biomass maps, and we will be able to look at change, however, with a big pinch of salt because of these biases we talked about. Those of you who are observant will have noticed there was a third method on my initial slide about satellite types. This is radar data. So radar is another type of satellite. It looks sideways at the world, sends pulses of microwave radiation, same kind of wavelengths you use to heat your food, and detects the radiation that scatters around trees and comes back to the satellite. Most of the radiation bounces off in the other direction, but if there's something interesting on the surface, something three-dimensional containing water that's gets noticed by these microwaves, some of that scattered energy comes back and gets detected. So the theory is that this should relate to the biomass stored in an area of land. If you have a few scattered trees, you might get a little bit of backscatter, and if you have a big, dense canopy forest, you get lots coming back to the satellite, and therefore you see a brighter image where there's more trees. So excitingly, this sees the three-dimensional structure. If your trees are bigger and taller and wider, you should get more return. We don't have that problem from optical data of just seeing the canopy. And even more excitingly, at the wavelengths we tend to use for looking at forests, clouds are transparent. Clouds don't get in the way. So I can see my bit of Gabon that's always cloud-covered without any issues. This is what a radar scene actually looks like after we've done some initial calibration and corrections. You can see it's not intuitively obvious what's going on. For a start, it's a grayscale image because we only have one band. And this isn't how our eyes see the world, so it always looks a bit difficult to interpret. This is a bit of tropical forest in southern Cameroon. We have some rivers that hopefully you can detect. We have mostly blanket tropical forest. We have a town here and here with some deforestation around them, some more there, and we have some patches of savanna as well, and some floodplains along the rivers that don't have any trees, so they're dark. The areas that are bright are forest, the areas that are dark are non-forest. You also see all these hills with a bright side on one side and a shadow on the other. Because the satellite is looking from this direction, it gets more return from the slopes that are facing the sensor than the slopes that are facing away from the sensor. So it doesn't mean that all the trees on this side are higher biomass than the trees on the other side of the hills. We have to correct for that topography if we're going to convert this brightness signal into some idea of biomass. Superficially, it does give you similar information to optical data. So I have an optical scene on the left and a radar scene on the right. These are both collected on the same day in 2014, I think, over a bit of Rondônia in Brazil that's had a lot of deforestation going on. And they show you pretty much the same picture. So on the radar scene, we have bright colours where there's forest, it's dark green in the optical scene, and the dark bits are the bits where we've been clearing. These are fields to be clear. There's some herringbone logging going on here, you can see. There are a few differences, though. This bit here, if you can see this little patch, the forest looks dark green in the optical data. In the radar, it's a different colour. It's a lighter colour with a kind of whiter colour rather than green. That's because this has been selectively logged. We know that from the ground. There's big trees have been taken out of here, and it probably will be cleared over the coming years. So we can see that in the radar because it sees into the canopy and can detect there's fewer big trees there, whereas the optical data still looks green. So that gives us some confidence that this can map degradation and can map biomass. We can try and model how this interaction works. So in order to get too into the technicalities of radar, this is a slide from one of my radar remote sensing lectures that you're all welcome to come to one day. It interacts with the crown, largely the stem, and then the ground, and you can use different polarizations of radar data to try and work out which bits are dominating the signal. So if you can find out where the return's coming from, you know something about the structure of the trees, whether you've removed a few big trees and just have a lot of small trees left, whether the forest is tall or short, whether the ground is wet or dry. I do quite a lot of work mapping peatlands, where knowing about how strong the double bounce turn, where radar hits the trees, hits the ground and bounces back, how strong that is tells you something about the ground, because the wetter the ground, the more it's able to reflect energy back to the satellite. I won't go into this now, but yeah, it's good to know that can exist. But the fundamentals I want to show you is that radar is sensitive to forest biomass. The things we suspected would be true looking at that initial comparison between optical and radar data appears to match. This is data for about 250 field plots across different forest types in Africa. These are all plotted on the same graph. The data is the same on these two figures. It's just that the one on the right I've logged the x-axis to make it easier to see. And you see there's a fairly consistent relationship between radar backscatter and biomass. So we showed this in 2009. This was the first time that people really showed that there was a relatively consistent relationship across different forest types. There's lots of assumptions in the literature that radar could be used to map biomass. It was thought that the relationship might be very different if your soil type is different or if the trees are a different structure. We show that that does have some effect, but largely you can predict biomass purely based on the backscatter. This has since been used by hundreds of other studies that have used this satellite to map biomass and biomass change. There is a problem, though. Like most things of remote sensing, we have saturation at some point. So this relationship begins to tail off and become less good. We don't really have any power with this sensor to tell the difference between a forest of 200 tonnes and a forest with 800 tonnes biomass per hectare. They have the same backscatter. That's a problem we'll get to in a moment, but just to show you that you can use this relationship to map biomass. This, for example, is a map of Bamjaram National Park in Cameroon for 2007. I could difference it with another scene from 1996. And show changes. So in this area we see lots of regrowing forest in areas that have become part of the national park and not being burned, and we see lots of deforestation along a railway line on the east of the scene. And fortunately there are some optical data, so I can try and convince you that this change we're seeing is real. So in data we can understand, in 2000 to 2006 this area becomes much greener, whereas around this town in the northeast of the scene between 2000 and 2006 we clearly get an expansion of the town and a loss of forest. We can use this to map biomass change. But this saturation is a problem. Again, that site is a forest savanna transition site. The biomass doesn't get that high. But if we were to look in proper tall tropical forests, I wouldn't be able to see a lot of degradation unless it became really severe. Those data I showed you were using L-band wavelength. There's a wavelength of sensor about 25 centimeters, so it's that kind of thing. In general, radar responds to elements of a forest that are a similar size to the wavelength. So L-band is not really going to see any leaves because they're too small. It's going to see the branches and the stem. This is a nice, this is an alpine tree, so a study based on some trees in the Alps, but fundamentally for a 50-meter tall tropical tree, L-band is not going to see the stem. It's going to see the branches and the big branches and the bit at the top of the stem, but it's probably never going to penetrate through the canopy enough to see the ground. What we really like is P-band, the longer wavelength. This is about 70 centimetres. That's going to respond to the biggest branches and the trunk only. And those are the components of a tree that hold most of the biomass. So for that reason, we have a sensor. It's recently been funded by the European Space Agency called, imaginatively enough, Biomass. It will be launched in 2021. It will collect this type of data and should give us much better maps of global biomass. Until then, we're stuck using L-band and we cope with its limitations. There is an even longer wavelength, VHF. It's not going to be possible to put that on a satellite because the atmosphere isn't transparent enough. But there have been some data collected from aircraft in VHF, and you can really see the individual trunks. And it's very nice. It does work well. You can combine these different wavelengths. People often ask me about that, so I put this figure up. So in an ideal world, we'd have a satellite collecting, say, data at X-band, L-band, and P-band, and we can make a nice colour map of forest that would show something about different forest types. So these different colours here in La Selva, Costa Rica, are to do with forests that are different heights, different kind of structures and age that we logged at different times in the past. But fundamentally, radar satellites are very power limited. They have to send pulses of microwave radiation at the Earth. And if you were to put more wavelengths up on the satellite, it would get really big, have to have really big solar panels, and it's just not practical. we can collect this type of data from aircraft, which is really nice. So to summarise this bit, we just talked about this trade-off with biomass sensitivity. So at short wavelength, you have low sensitivity to biomass because you're only seeing things high up in the canopy. As your wavelength gets longer, you have higher sensitivity to biomass. But as often happens with remote sensing, there's another trade-off with resolution. So for high biomass, long wavelength, you have a maximum resolution that's quite low. The biomass satellites will produce biomass maps at a 200-meter resolution. That's 4 hectares per pixel. That's probably too coarse for quite a few applications. X-band is a sensor called TerraStar X that can produce maps at 1 meter resolution. You can see the crowns of individual trees. It's fantastic. But of course, it doesn't penetrate far into the forest canopy, so that's the limitation. These are some radar satellites. The main reason I wanted to show this was just to show that in the past, most satellites were short wavelength, they're smaller and easier to build, and increasingly we're now getting to longer wavelengths. The sensors in red are ones that are going to be launched soon, and ones in bold are the ones that are active. So for my research, I've increasingly been using LM and soon P-band sensors to map biomass properly, and that's very exciting for us. I just want to have one slide on interferometry to show you that you can use radar data from different angles to tell you something about tree height. So you can use the interference of the waves to make maps of tree height and tree height change. It's very difficult to do over forests because leaves and things are not very consistent, so if you come back a day later, everything might have changed a bit if the wind direction has changed. It's an interesting area of development, how you could use shorter wavelength radar sensors with a high resolution and this interferometry to look at changes in tree height. I've talked a bit about biomass, so this is launched in 2021. P-band will collect biomass maps. It's 200 meter resolution, which often people think isn't very good. So 4 hectare pixels, it's much bigger than our forest plots. Maybe that's not going to show us very much. I just wanted to put this slide up to compare it to the two biomass maps I was talking about before. So the Sarchi et al. And the Puccini et al. Maps at 1 kilometer resolution and about 500 meter resolution. And this is some simulated biomass level 2 data from an aircraft campaign over a bit of Lopé National Park, a very cloudy bit of Gabon. I just want to show you that this map is far superior to either of these two, in that that resolution really does make a difference. You've got about 6 pixels for every Puccini pixel. It doesn't sound like much difference, 463 meters to 200 meters. But visually, you can see that's very different. And the dynamic range seems to be much higher for this radar data. We're really seeing the pixels with high biomass and the pixels with low biomass in a way we just don't see in the Puccini map. So maybe resolution isn't everything. These maps seem to be much more smoothed out in general. They don't have the capacity to show the low and the high pixels. Because they're effectively optical maps, they're not seeing below the canopy. We haven't changed anything in the fundamental physics. We can also use radar and optical data in combination. For example, we can map peatland area using the benefits of both. So in this case, I was looking at whether or not soils were wet using radar data and using the colour of the optical data to tell us something about how palmy an area is, how much palms it has compared to how many tall trees. And this let us map the peatlands of the Congo Basin. We discovered the largest peatland in the tropics. People knew there was a bit of wetland here, but they didn't know that it was carrying peat. We used field measurements to show that peat was there and then extrapolated it with remote sensing and found a peatland about the size of England. So together they can be useful as well. So to conclude, from radar data, it can see through cloud and penetrate vegetation, but it still has a problem with saturation unless you're at very long wavelengths. And unfortunately, there's no long wavelength satellite currently, but biomass will be launched in 2021. And also, the data is not normally free. That's changing. There's a bit of a tendency towards releasing satellite data sets, particularly to scientists. That's currently happened for optical data. Apart from the highest resolution satellites, most optical data is free. Radar is probably about 10 years behind in releasing data sets. So often if I do write a grant application, I have to put in money for purchasing radar data, which I rarely have to do for optical data. So what can we actually do to solve that problem, to map biomass and biomass change? Well, we can do aircraft-based LiDAR, but it's very expensive. We can use satellite-based LiDAR, but we have very patchy spots of data, and we have to wait for a mission to turn up, and radar data saturates. But we could wait for biomass. Or maybe we could do better with our current technologies. Maybe we're not using them to their full potential. So we've entered the Sentinel era. Right now, we have a new set of satellites funded by the European Union. UK government put about $2.5 billion into this program as well. So they're a European Union thing and we're leaving. I think we still own a lot of these satellites and hopefully we'll continue to use the data. These are collecting far more data than we've ever had before in terms of high-quality science observations. So Sentinel-1 has two C-band radar satellites. They're collecting about 4 terabytes of data per day and imaging most of the Earth's surface every 12 days and the European Union every 6 days. That's far more data than we've ever had. So ALOS Pulsar, the L-band radar satellite that I've shown you before, tends to image the tropics about twice to four times a year, nowhere near the 6 days we're getting here. Sentinel-2, similarly, it's a higher resolution satellite than Landsat, 10 meter resolution, but images the whole world every 5 days compared to every 14 for Landsat. Again, a big difference, producing 6 terabytes a day between the two satellites. So there's also Sentinel-3, which is a MODIS replacement, a coarser resolution optical sensor. Again, covering the whole world every 2 days with loads of bands. So I was wondering a few years ago, before these were launched, whether we'd be able to use this plethora of data, this explosion of data happening so often during the year, to map biomass better. Or at the very least, could we use this kind of time series data to map biomass change? Even if you couldn't tell the absolute biomass of a pixel, could you tell if it had lost 20% or 40% of its biomass through time? To test this, I've won a European Research Council grant called FOBEX, the Tropical Forest Degradation Experiment. I'm going to set up some plots to try and use these data to map degradation and regrowth. So most forest plots don't change very much. Fundamentally, you go back and remeasure a forest plot. It's in a national park. It's maybe increased a bit. Maybe there's been a big tree fall that decreases a bit. Maybe if you're really lucky, someone's come and turned it into a ranch and you have 100% loss of biomass. We have very few plots that have lost 60% or 40% of their carbon stocks. So it's hard for me to test whether that thing I was just talking to you about is true. So what we're going to do in FODEX is set up a load of plots in logging concessions, obviously start at 100%, we're going to jump down different ranges of the full range of degradation, because we'll ask the loggers to cut down particular trees, and then we'll track them during regrowth as well, so hopefully we'll see these ranges of increase. I want to use these to hopefully use our current satellite data better to map biomass change. So we're going to do this by collecting, creating 52 permanent sample plots split between a logging session in Gabon and Peru. We're going to measure all the trees, collect terrestrial laser scanner data in partnership with, in partnership with Matt Disney at University College London. We're going to create terrestrial laser scanner data. We're going to collect LiDAR data from that unmanned aerial vehicle, that drone I showed you. So we'll get these nice kind of maps of the plots where we know exactly where every tree is. We're then going to log the trees and collect all the same data again, so we get these change measurements very accurately. To compare to those, we're going to collect all useful satellite data, so all those Sentinel data sets, plus everything else I can get my hands on, and create and test lots of different algorithms for mapping biomass change. And hopefully once we've done that, we can create biome-scale maps of above-ground biomass, or particularly above-ground biomass change. I hope very much to be able to come back here in about 5 years' time and show you that we've succeeded in doing that, or at least we'll know for certain that you can't do it if that's the case. I don't know if these large time series, these petabytes of data we're collecting, tell us something about biomass change, but at least we'll have the ground data set to find out after this experiment. Okay, I think that's my time up. Do we have any questions?